The title of tonight's talk and our inquiry is Through the Veil. I was sitting today outside in the sun and the shade, happily, very happily in summer, and I started thinking about tonight's talk, what to talk about, what's been happening in my life, seeing if what's been happening in my life need a talk. And so I started reflecting on my life and remembered getting this book last week in the mail. It's called Dancing with Joy. And
Roger Houston.
And it's 99 poems. He's the author of the 10 poems series, 10 poems to change your life, 10 poems. Not sure of all the titles. Dancing with Joy, 99 of them. And so I started looking through this, and one poem really moved me. Several did, but this is the poem that spoke to me today, written by my favorite poet, Mary Oliver. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone, yet it is ours, and not by the century or the year, but by the hours. One fall day, I heard above me, and above the sting of the wind, a sound I did not know, and my look shot upward. It was a flock of snow geese, winging faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes, to stop time when something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright, but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if delight were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I have never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. A mindfulness poem. I thought today of my friend Patricia, who was with me yesterday when we were in our women's sitting group. And what she said when she checked in with the group about what's been current was that she'd just been on a retreat, a five-day retreat, and she'd come to understand mindfulness in a way she never had before. She said she's had a, she didn't use these words, but she implied she's had a slight aversion to mindfulness, that she so favors metta, or loving kindness, that that's her practice. Her practice is really something she's talked about with me over the years as not being quite kosher, not quite, quote, Buddhist. Said she lies down in bed. She doesn't sit. She lies down every morning. And she experiences and imagines going towards light, being enveloped in light. So first it's an imagining. And then it's a whole body-mind experience of being enveloped in light, which to her is the felt sense and experience of love. She's talked with teachers over the years and has asked, is this metta? Is this loving-kindness practice? Is this Vipassana practice? What is this practice? I don't sit up. She's had some conflict with the nature of her practice. And my friend, Patricia, has a very deep connection with truth, with the way things are. Enlightenment is light, is love. And she was on a retreat, and one of the teachers said, mindfulness, or sati, is metta. It is love. It's infused with kindness. And for her, it was like, all right, I'm doing this practice right in some way. But to her, it was more than just a confirmation. It was a deep yes, a resonance to her of, I guess it was a confirmation. It meant a lot to her. Mindfulness is embedded or infused with loving kindness. So today, sitting in the sun, I was also taking some time to write. And I was writing about a time in my life that was really painful. In the last few weeks, we've been talking here about the rhythms and waves of life, that sometimes life is expanding, sometimes life is contracting, our life, my life, the way things are in this world, that all of life is a continuous flow that sometimes is expanding and sometimes contracting. This period of my life was a real period of contraction, a real period of pain, a period where I felt that I was going to die if I stayed where I was or if I left. My life changed. The past was how I came to feel a lot of shame at that time, the circumstances of my past, my conditioning, the way I was raised had taught me that getting pregnant at 16 as a good Catholic girl was a horrible thing, just a terrible thing. And I really felt a lot of shame, felt deep pain. And at just turned 18 with a then one-year-old daughter and a husband who was 3 years older than me in a marriage that wasn't working, I was so afraid of what to do. I was so afraid to leave. I couldn't imagine what I would do, having dropped out of high school, no education. What could I do? Really felt like I was going to die one way or the other. And today, in looking at that, I could feel the memory of that. Really feel the memory of the pain of that time. I was also today making plans to go to Washington, D.C. next month to be part of a government briefing for families of people who were missing in action or prisoners of war from the Korean War, Cold War era. My father was missing in action, as many of you know, in the Korean War almost 55 years ago. And making those plans also brings up a lot of sadness for me. Just about the anniversary of the September 9th date, 2 years old, who could remember? But there's memories that stay in the body that are pretty deep and really inform us in how we meet the world now from a psychological perspective. you might say, restore memories in the body. And bringing them to mind can be painful. Habits, shame, conditioning, pain, truth, freedom, now, psychological, dharma, big view, looking at the psychological through form, through the form of this body, through the form of emotion, and looking at the truth of the dharma in any given moment, right in the middle of that place of constriction, of contraction, there can be what I've come to think of as moments of space, of freedom, right within all that pain and suffering. Kind of like putting on a cleat, or a golf shoe with those little spiky cleats that aerate, give space to the ground, that give a little traction to the moment. Or when you're a gardener and you put those little punctures into the earth to give space for the earth to breathe and new life to come through. In talking last week about stopping and dropping, it's not just a put the butt down once a day or once a week or however often we put the butt down, which is the usual position to stop and meditate. We can puncture our days many times with just moments of freedom. Moments of freedom. And that's all we really have, these moments of freedoms. Because none of us here that I know of has sustained freedom. Not enlightened, but there's enlightenments in the only time we can be enlightened, right now. Right now. So in the midst of all of our pain and suffering and all of our joys, right in the midst of our lives can be moments of freedom. Those moments are worth stopping for and paying attention to. We can miss them. Sometimes we only notice what's painful. Starting to stop once an hour can just bring some moments of fresh air into this, what seems to be solid life, into these moments of constriction and expansion. The Dharma looks at both emptiness and form, both emptiness and form as being one, as being two sides of the same coin, two sides of the same coin, moments of freedom, moments of non-clinging, moments of seeing through into reality, moments of mindfulness, right in the middle of this day-to-day life, form, breath, form. Everything we have is right here. Everything we need is right here. The Buddha said it. And the more we pay attention to our experience that confirms the teachings, the more we know it to be the truth. So under the coverings of the mind, coverings of habit, under the coverings of the veils, we see space, we feel space, we experience. So I was looking at my last night today also, when I spent 2.5 hours talking with people who came to find out about mindfulness-based stress reduction, a new series I'm going to start. Talking about mindfulness, what is it? Many people have heard the word mindfulness. It's pretty much pervading the culture. The words dharma pervade the culture. We're talking about our identity here, what to call ourselves here. Are we a Vipassana community, insight? You know, are we mindfulness, which is really the center of Vipassana, of the process of awakening through which we see clearly right there, right into the center, that calm place in the center of the hurricane, the eye, right there is the eye of mindfulness that sees clearly into the nature of reality. So what are we? We're a Vipassana community. With mindfulness as our core. As our core. Intention. And as our core goal. See clearly into the nature of the truth of the way things are. And when we start to see clearly, everything opens into the wash of continuous, amazing change. Continuous, amazing change, constantly. Appears to be solid because we live in this human body, in this human form. I don't know what it looks like to Obi, who's my dog. You know, I don't know what other beings see. I don't think any of us do, but we see through these eyes. And this peering through the eye of mindfulness leads to the ultimate goal of freedom, the ultimate goal of awakening. Yay. Yay. It's the good news. The Buddha taught only two things. The truth of suffering, the freedom available right now when we see through the illusion of continuity of me in this body that so feels solid, sometimes feels a little lighter at those moments of seeing clearly, but oftentimes feels pretty solid. Bonnie, Mark, solid, huh? Yeah, Kevin. And those moments we see into that truth, it's the big, The Buddha really tried to deny form as the Bodhisattva walking the path towards enlightenment. He tried in every single way to mortify the body. Didn't feed it, hardly clothed it, didn't sleep much, did everything to deny the body, and it didn't work. It just didn't work. After years of wandering and practicing and finding comrades and really finding like-minded people with just a little dust in their eyes, and the dust being there's only emptiness and not form. I'm going to get rid of this form in any way I can. And after many years, mindfulness peered in and said, not the way. It's not the way. And he walked down to the village and was offered food for the form, food for the body, and he ate it. So he ate food to nourish this body and this form so that he had the endurance to sit again, to sit under that tree and put the hand down and say, hey, as my witness, Earth, I've done a lot of work here. and I'm going to sit here until all of the dust is gone from these eyes, until the eye of mindfulness is clear. And he sat there through the three watches of the night and woke up and saw clearly into the truth and uprooted the fetters that kept him bound to the cycles of selfing. We have those glimpses, and those are worth paying attention to and stopping for. I can remember as a respiratory therapist for years, there was hardly ever or often not much time to stop. There were cycles of new busyness. There were cycles of losing people, of patients dying, of babies dying, that were so painful, and nobody stopped. Nobody stopped to feel the pain of that. We didn't talk about it because, we just didn't. Because it was too painful to say out loud. Who knows, we might cry. And I can remember taking those moments and going into the bath and crying. Just taking those moments to stay and stop and feel the emotions that were going through this body-mind. And it was helpful. It was really helpful. So in talking with people last night, I spoke of mindfulness really as being something we can cultivate through paying attention, something that strengthens, and something that's there all the time. It's already there, ready to help the veils to move, to part. In the seeing clearly, the Buddha realized that the only true path to awakening was a path of balance, a path of seeing both emptiness and form as one and the same thing. It's one and the same thing. Sometimes we may feel that emptiness or no selfness is something to put on a pedestal. This is where we're going. We're going towards emptiness. For some people, the word emptiness brings up a lot of fear. Aloneness, it means. It means, I asked people last week, it meant meaninglessness to some. It meant fear to others. And to others, it means where we're going towards emptiness. All the same thing. Very ordinary here. It's very ordinary, and it's like this. It's very ordinary, two sides of the same coin. We're here, sitting in this body that appears solid, and it's empty, and we're all connected. That's the basic bottom truth. Mindfulness is direct knowing, and it's before the note or the naming that we give to the experience. It's like we're always trying to catch up, even with a noting or a naming practice. It's like we're always behind the curve. You know, it's like it's already happened by the time we give it a name. It's already happened, yet it's really helpful to have that noting and naming practice because it connects us with experience. But it's not the thing itself. It's not the perception pure behind the word cutting through. It's like a knife. Mindfulness is like a knife that just cuts right through into the truth. I was thinking of the teachings that we give in the mindfulness-based stress reduction series, talking about the attitudinal foundations of mindfulness. And I don't think we in different ways talk about each of these seven attitudinal foundations in our community, but it's not one of the Buddha's lists. However, what they are is the soil where the seed goes in of mindfulness. So it helps the seed to come to fruition. So those foundations include non-judgmental awareness, the judgments that we put on to our experiences are simply painful and unnecessary and quite related to conditioning and habits, how we've learned to view life. Some of us have been raised by parents who were pretty awake, pretty clear. When I think of my friend Lynn, I think of her parents, at least in what she's told me about them, as being pretty clear. I don't know of any other person who's 67, 68 years old, who was raised by a mother who is a Buddhist practitioner and took it to heart. And my friend Lynn was raised with a lot of love and a lot of kindness, a lot of acceptance, which is another one of these foundations that help to support mindfulness. So these judgments that come into our minds, noted as judgment. Many of us have heard that judgment is that second arrow. Sometimes the pain of what we're feeling is compounded by the judgment of that. The pain of being an 18-year-old and feeling shame. You know, I don't even know if there, at that time, actually, there probably was no judging, feeling the shaming, because I didn't know that what I was feeling and experiencing was the result of the teachings I've learned about how I was supposed to be. So cultivating non-judging, a non-judging mind when we sit, close our eyes, when we walk through our lives, I think I've related to our Sangha sometimes a story about going on retreat and walking meditation, pretty clearly lifting, moving, placing, knowing what was happening. Thought come, emotion come, all of a sudden the thought came. Well, you're just not creative. That one I didn't pay attention to, I didn't even notice for many minutes. And after many minutes, when I realized that I judged myself, you're just not creative, I didn't pick up on that thought because I felt it was the truth. It was so much the truth that I wasn't even aware of it. It didn't go underneath the veil. And it was very painful. It actually made me cry. We have a lot of these thoughts a lot of the time. So cultivating non-judgmental awareness starts by noticing when there's judgment. Cultivating patience, which is something that as United Statesians, people of the West, we're not often very good at. Patience. Patience is one of the paramis or one of the awakened qualities of the heart, or the qualities of an awakened heart. Patience is not waiting. Very different than waiting. I remember Ram Dass talking very slowly, very soon after his stroke at Spirit Rock at a benefit. And when he was being taken off the stage, people were getting restless. It was taking a long time. When he was talking, people were restless too. Stephen Levine got up after he spoke and asked the question. He said, "Are you waiting? Or are you being patient?" Very different. Patience is not waiting for something to happen. You know, that sitting with what is in practice and that waiting for the bell to ring. Will it ever? So cultivating patience. Cultivating beginner's mind. Boy, in this society, we want to be experts. And there's a lot of pain around that for many people. Beginner's mind, a lot of people, many of us don't want to be beginners. I've been practicing for a long time. I've been teaching for a long time. I am. And we really look up to people who are experts often. Cultivating beginner's mind, boy, what a gift to be seeing things for the first time. There's that excitement of like, wow, this is new. I was once at a conference and someone gave a talk and talked about being with a group of people in a South American culture once, and hearing about how a shaman was selected at birth by the current shaman, and placed in a cave for years, just taught by the shaman, taught about the natural world. And this man told the story of the young shaman coming out of the cave and seeing the world for the first time. Everything he'd only heard about. Seeing water, seeing sky, seeing rain, seeing sun, seeing earth, seeing people. Beginner's mind. What if we had beginner's mind for those of us in, which is every one of us, in relationship to people? What if we saw someone you know with beginner's mind? You might just fall in love again. Or you might get to know your child in a different way. Recently I was with my daughter at her 40th birthday, and I talked about her, and I remembered something, an instance a few years before, when her neighbor, Lisa's neighbor across the street, was over at Lisa's house, and he said to me, "Your daughter's wonderful." And I said, "She's so much fun." And he corrected me. He said, "Your daughter's a lot more than fun." And she is. And I really remembered that. So in talking about her, I told that story because it really made me stop and look at Lisa with beginner's mind and see someone who wasn't my daughter, who was a beautiful, wonderful, giving, caring woman in through someone else's eyes and through fresh new eyes. And that's beginner's mind. Trust, cultivating trust, and trust is not in someone else. It's starting to trust in our own basic goodness and knowledge and self, unself, non-self, deep knowing. Deep knowing. I can remember, you know, I did my master's research project on women, weight, body image, and health from a non-dieting, positive body image perspective. And up until that time, I think I'd been on a diet like almost all my life, since the fourth grade, the first time I heard my aunt who was visiting from Texas say to the rest of the women in my family, "Bonnie's fat." It's like, oh my God, Bonnie's fat. It's like, oh, it's so painful. And I went on my first diet right then. And there was a way in which I never trusted the truth that diets don't work. They don't work. So cultivating a trust in what we find out for ourselves to be the truth. Non-striving. We can cultivate this practice and this muscle of mindfulness by not trying to get anywhere. Not to say this practice doesn't take effort, but it's right effort. It's right effort. Striving is very different. It's like trying to get somewhere. Oh, is that a burden? Trying so hard to get somewhere. Being where we are. That's all we need to do. Be where we are. Pay attention to that. Acceptance, which is very different than being a doormat. Very different. Acceptance is wisdom that says, this is the way things are. This is the way things are. Doesn't mean you have to like it, but it is the way it is. As Ajahn Sumedho says, it's like this. It's like this. Fear? Like this. It feels the same. It's experienced the same for you as it is experienced for me. Because it's like this, fear. And letting go. Boy, that's a... it's something we can't make ourselves do. Have you ever tried to let go? Oh, so painful. Oh, I could let go. Oh. Yet we know how to let go. Each and every one of us knows how to let go because we go to sleep. Even if we have insomnia, none of us stays awake all the time. So we know how to let go, and that is something that is cellular. It's here, yet it appears to be, for lack of another word, miraculous when it happens, especially when we've really been clinging. So those are the seven attitudinal foundations of mindfulness that really support the veils opening up. The word sati, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Mindfulness Sutta. The word sati in Pali is the Pali word for mindfulness. Sati reminds us. So there's a memory component to mindfulness. It reminds us to come back. over and over and over again. So anytime we're lost out there in stories of past or projecting into future, mindfulness kicks in and says, breath, right here, right now, pay attention, butt on the chair, what's that sensation, sound, minds us to pay attention, to let go, to come back. Sati sees clearly, right through, right through. Bear attention to the present moment. Bear attention. Sati sees the true nature of all phenomena. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. But a dream. Impermanent. Something we can count on. A lot of times people fear, fear, feel, fear, 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 feel, fear. In contemplation or experiencing and experiencing impermanence. What is there to hold onto? Where's the ground here? Where's the safe place? The safe place is right there, right in the middle of it, the wash. We can count on it. We can count on everything changing. That's something when we're stuck in the middle of something to come back to over and over and over again. This too shall pass. Big, deep wisdom. This too shall pass. Is really, this too is passing. We are a process. We are a process. All of life is a process. Expanding and contracting all the time. It's just the way it is. In the class, the mindfulness-based stress reduction class, there's often healthcare practitioners, research scientists, who I don't want to categorize as rational-minded and skeptical, yet I'll say the truth, that they are scientists. They're scientists. And what could be helpful for a scientist to hear is the same truth that we come to know in practice. This is a science. It's a science of mind. It is a science putting the microscope of sati into right now, right now, right now. And the scientists in the class can get into that. They can get into that. It's like, I said, just keep looking. Just, you know, you don't have to trust me. You don't, you know, these seven foundations. Just see for yourself. Make it a scientific inquiry. Vipassana, inquiry, insight. Somebody asked that question last night. What is this practice? Mindfulness practice. But is there another word? Vipassana. It's a vipassana practice. What does that mean? Insight. What is insight? Aha, aha, we know those moments, aha, yes, oh, I get it, under the lens. My friend Patricia, in seeing the truth of the moment of mindfulness, being kindness, touched. She touched a deep truth there. She touched a deep truth. Because when we peer through the microscope of mindfulness, clear through into the truth, the heart breaks. Absolutely breaks open in compassion for all this clinging and all this clinging in the world. It's the only rational act. It's the only way we really see through clearly. It is not a one-winged bird of insight and wisdom. It flies with compassion, which is kindness for ourselves and for everyone, because life's hard for a lot of people and for all of us in moments. So looking at those moments today, I remembered Princess Diana, and I thought of her many times before she died. She was out there trying to rid the world of landmines. And I don't think it's an accident that her heart grew to be compassionate in looking at, you know, the suffering that she experienced in her life. Of course, I wasn't in that mind body. Don't know what the intention was in her actions, but I think that there was compassion there for the suffering those landmines cause. Kindness, right in the middle of it all. So I want to, as I'm aware of our time, and I've spoken a lot, I want to end with a poem that you may have heard, but it doesn't matter. With beginner's mind, you can all hear it again. And it's called Kindness by Columbia. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. In kindness, we'll end in thinking of the person who cleans up after us. But I'm not always so thoughtful of. So let's sit together. Bring to mind some act of kindness you've recently done for yourself, someone else. For the planet. Be mindful of it and feel its waves inside. May we go our separate ways, remembering each other and the strong intentions inside to wake up, to be free. May we find peace in our hearts. May the world remember peace. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May the merit from our practice tonight be a benefit to all beings everywhere, without exception. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.